It's Sunday, August 30th, and you are listening to Peanuts and Popcorn. P&P is a spontaneous podcast between two old friends on baseball and motion pictures. I'm Tom Hockney.
And I'm Leo Fontana. This week on Peanuts and Popcorn, Jackie Robinson Day was Friday amid terrible violence in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The Chicago White Sox are rising to the top of the AL Central. Mets GM Brody Van Wagenen's tenure with the Mets may be coming to an end. The Cubs are struggling, and in the popcorn segment, we'll be talking about the Spanish film Belle Époque. How you doing, Tom?
Yeah, I'm old. You know, I was born before the internet, Leo.
As was I.
I graduated school with no Google, with no Wikipedia. Did you?
No, yeah, I graduated. I mean, by the time I got to college, I was learning how to do things on a word processor. But I really had no sense of the internet until much later.
The reason why I bring this up is because I know that you, as a teacher, you are now teaching from home.
Yeah, I'm doing distance.
I just want to ask a stupid question. So if I'm one of your students and you're talking about a subject and I'm on my computer in a whatever Zoom environment, whatever environment you guys have, can you tell if they're kind of cheating? Because you can't really use Google in an in-person thing, right? You don't let your folks use their phones, right?
No, I can't tell if they're cheating. I can't tell. I mean, if they have a second computer there, you know, maybe they can look some stuff up. You know, I can't tell what they're doing. And a lot of kids just turn their cameras off altogether. So I don't know what's going on, but that's really not even the hard part. The hard part is I'm stuck here at home. I'm in my basement. I've got three children of my own who are all doing distance learning in different parts of the house. And I can't really make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Right. You know?
And like I walked upstairs to go to the bathroom and then I saw that Nora was not at her desk when she was supposed to be.
Right.
She was playing on her little phone. And you know, I'm trying not to get mad about these things, but I'm like, this can't continue. And there's
why can't you just take all their phones from them?
That's the next step. That's the next step. And that's really what we're going to have to do. We started out trying to trust them. We went a week, you know, to sort of see how it was all going to sort of go.
Right.
But that's really something that we've been talking about. And, you know.
I know it's tough for you, but I wish when I was a kid I had these options because I would have definitely been that play baby problem child.
Well, I mean, I can't monitor the students' behavior, but I have to monitor the behavior of my own children.
Right, right.
And that's really sort of the problem. But there is some good news. You know, my daughter, we live next door to a really big public pool, and we're there every day as much as we can. You know, it's really a godsend to be able to go there. And my daughter, my youngest daughter, became the first of our three children to jump off the high dive. And I'll tell you something, that was a big moment for that little girl. She was so proud of herself. We were standing around, my wife and I, she said she was going to do it. She climbed up there. She looked pretty apprehensive initially. And then she just jumped off. And then when she came up for air, she's like, yes, with her fist in the air. And you know, we kind of made a big deal out of it, but these are big moments, you know, and the fact that she's the first of the three, that she did it before her older brother and her older sister, you know, that's a big deal for a little girl like Nora. So I'm really proud of her.
Well, not just that, but now the cat's out of the bag. And so it's like, there's no going back.
No.
So this is a really good thing in many respects, in my opinion, because it puts kind of pressure on the other two. What are they going to do? One of them may say, I'm not doing it. I don't care. Or they both may say it, but that's something that Nora now has over them.
It really is. And because she does not have much over them. And this is one thing that she's got. And it's nice. It's nice.
Hey, and for years we stayed in Jamaica. We stayed on the cliffs. And you could dive off the cliffs into basically the ocean. There was like a 15-footer. And there was like a 25-footer. And then if you really had balls, you went to Rick's. And that was like 75 or 100 feet. It basically, you just go to an edge, and once you get to that edge, there's no turning back, and you jump off.
And the only way to get off, you can't climb down.
Correct. And so we're at the cliffs, and I'm doing the 15-footer all day, every day. The 25 footer, I did it once and it hurt. It's like, you know, parts of my body hurt. And so one time we went with a group of like 10 people, and then nobody would go to Rick's except my wife, Gwen.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then, and Gwen was like Esther Williams out there. Like she kicked that cliff's ass. So she was our Nora. And believe me, after that, she was pretty, you know, cocksure of herself.
That's cool. Yeah. So now there is a bit of sad news that we want to recognize here on the show, and that's the passing of Chadwick Boseman, the actor who played Black Panther. He played Prince T'Challa in Black Panther. He was Thurgood Marshall. He also played Jackie Robinson. Yep. He died at the age of, 43 years old of colon cancer? And nobody knew. You know, it was a huge surprise. Everybody thought it was a hoax.
Right.
But he did die. And, you know, these are tough times if you're a Black person, because this is a man who was really, really loved.
Yeah.
Not only by just everybody who worked with him and just movie fans in general, but he really meant something to African Americans in this country. And it's really sad. I mean, I saw Black Panther. I thought it was okay as a movie, but it was really important to Black people. And then to play such iconic figures like Thurgood Marshall and Jackie Robinson, I mean, you know, he really had a tremendous career. And you know, it's sad to see him die so young. It really is.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And just to put it in historical perspective, from a film standpoint, this is a huge loss to motion pictures.
If
occasionally through time, younger actors have died way before their time. James Dean comes to mind. He'd only made 3 films by the time he passed at age 23, and he became kind of an icon after the fact. This is similar to that in the sense that, first of all, this guy was a tremendous actor. Yeah. He had the chops. It wasn't just smoke and mirrors with this guy. And while his body of work was mostly biopics, they were meaningful biopics, movies that had to be made. And I think that his loss is immeasurable. And it's in a year that will go down as maybe the worst year in all of our collective lives. This is just another punch to the gut, and it's just it's tragic, and it's ironic that he died on Jackie Robinson Day.
It really
that's just kind of spooky to a certain degree.
It is, and let's talk a little bit about Jackie Robinson Day. And this is the day in the major leagues where they recognize the breaking of the color barrier, because in 1947 Jackie Robinson was the first African-American to play in the major leagues since before 1900. And, his story is a difficult one, full of struggle and, you know, certainly overt and outright racism, the things that he had to put up with, especially those first few years in the majors when he was the only Black player playing in baseball. And, I want to say that I do think the way that they have everybody wear the number 42, knowing what I know about Jackie Robinson, I think he would not appreciate that kind of gesture. You know, if he were with us today, he would be like, no, I don't like the fact that everybody has to wear my number. You know, baseball at its heart is a game. We need to see the different numbers of the different players. I think that if he were with us, that's what he would say.
I think you're probably right, but it kind of reminds me of what Ken Burns tried to put forward in the baseball documentary, and that is, this act is showing baseball's conscience over how it behaved 40 or 50, oh, actually 70, 80 years ago at this point, and after that fact, and still to this day in some small way, but not as bad as it used to be. I just think this is baseball's conscience rearing up, saying we have to do something. And just having a 42 fly in every stadium is not good enough. So I kind of get what they're trying to do about that. But I also see your perspective too. I think that Jackie Robinson, who ended up, I think in some respects, being very conservative about things, would potentially have issues with this. But I just thought that, again, more irony, Jackie Robinson Day this week, and then you have this unbelievable thing occur in Wisconsin. that triggered basically a reaction by all of the collective sports in the United States.
And yeah, the shooting of Jacob Blake by a Kenosha police officer. He was shot 7 times in the back. He was taken to the hospital, underwent surgery. It looks like he's going to survive, but he may be paralyzed from the waist down for the rest of his life. You know, everybody saw the video of him getting shot, and this led to subsequent riots in Kenosha. And then a 17-year-old kid from, I guess, Antioch, Illinois, crossed the border, took an AR-15 rifle and killed 2 protesters and shot another one. And you're just like, what is going on here?
Right. Madness. Like, madness.
Madness. And it had a huge impact on baseball, as the Milwaukee Brewers opted not to play, as did the Milwaukee Bucks.
The Bucks started it. The Milwaukee Bucks are the ones that started it. And the Brewers followed suit. And it was just kind of interesting of how some teams canceled, some teams didn't, and the motivations behind why they did it. It wasn't all about, you know, in protest or against protest. Some of it, as you can imagine, was based on money and you know, loss of revenue and typical reason.
It'd be to make up the games.
Correct. Yeah. But it's just a crazy world that we're living in, and it seems as though baseball is starting to become woke to a certain degree, like a lot of the other sports are. It's a tragic time. My mother's been dead for 15, 16 years now, and I can't imagine how she would look at all of this, because she was born in the Great Depression, so she lived through a lot of crap. But this is right up there, in my opinion. If COVID-19 is just an insidious foe that, in my mind, I can't see it being over with for maybe a year or two. I mean, I don't think people can really. It's like if you ever go to the doctor, and this has happened to me many times, where I have an issue, like I've had knee problems. They only would give me a report for 2 weeks. They would say, "Oh yeah, there is what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks." And I'm like, "Well, what about in the next month?" They're like, "You can't handle the truth." it's kind of like that. And this is the way it is with COVID. It's like, if we really knew how long this was going to take, we can't handle the truth. Yeah. That's the bottom line.
No, I know. And I don't know how I'm going to manage teaching from home. You will.
You'll figure it out.
Well, COVID aside, though, I mean, these are really hard times. I wanted to mention this. Did you see or hear Brian Urlacher's comments on Twitter?
Oh, my God. Brian, first of all, I'm not surprised. You come from a part of the country where, you know, it's Trump country. People talk like that. They do it second nature. They don't even know what they're doing, and they're saying it. Urlacher, you cost yourself not only a lot of fans, but a lot of money.
Endorsement deals. He's going to lose a lot of money in endorsement deals, and quite honestly, the Bears will probably distance themselves from him. You know, because the Bears have kind of been out in front on this stuff. They canceled practices. They released a supportive statement of Jacob Blake. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that he probably shouldn't have said that, and he may regret it, but he's probably going to be right at the center of raising money for this white kid with the rifle for his legal defense. So I don't know.
I thought in that Athletic article, there was a great quote by LaTroy Hawkins, who said, I heard this somewhere, it's not mine. He goes, Caucasians want our rhythm, but they don't want our blues.
No, that's right. That's a great line. But it's tough. I mean, you know, the thing that really disturbed me was the kid who went in with his freaking AR-15
and
started shooting. You know, he's a mixed up kid who's, I don't know, kind of has a distorted worldview.
Well, his parents are white supremacists. So he grew up in that environment.
I didn't know that they were white
supremacists. Yeah. But well, I mean, I read that. Whether that's true or not, who knows? But that was purported in the news.
But I don't want to, what I'm going to say may sound a little controversial, and I don't want this to sound like a what about?
Yeah.
But here you have this white kid who goes into the riot or whatever, who goes into the protest and kills two people. But then, I mean, how different is he from the 17-year-old black kid on the South Side who opens fire with a handgun and kills some little kid? You know what I mean?
He's not. He's not. It's the same madness. Without a doubt. The difference is that this kid, if you saw any of the video, was kind of propped up by the police department. And that's where it gets a little dicey. You got a 17-year-old with a military-style AR-15 that, you know, as I saw in one part of the video, the one guy that died basically has his arm amputated because that weapon is not meant to be in the streets or in civilians' hands. I don't care what anybody says. Hey, I own some weapons because I live in a rural part where sometimes you run into animals. You have to have them to take care of yourself. But there's no reason that you need a weapon like this, certainly not in the hands of a minor. And so, it's just an absolute tragedy, but it's causing America to take a look at itself, to hold up a mirror against itself, to say, what the hell is going on? And it's just time after time after time. I completely support what it happened, whatever that was, Tuesday night, where sports basically shut down to a certain degree. But it's got to be more than that. I thought it was interesting on the NBA's approach. You know who was leading the charge was Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan
as the owner was consult and Barack Obama were consulting the LeBron Jameses of the world as far as what's the best way to play this. And so this is just a very complicated, sad time in America. When I see things like this, when I live through weeks like this, it makes me embarrassed to be an American. I don't like feeling that way. I don't like feeling that way.
Oh, well, and you know, did you see the press conference with Dominic Smith?
Oh, yeah.
Now, he got really emotional when talking to reporters about Jacob Blake and Black Lives Matter. There was an article by Justin Toscano about that. And that was really poignant, I got to say, you know, because the fact is that, you know, he's got to tell his son, or if he has children, or if he has boys, he's got to tell his children to be aware of the things that he's doing and to instruct him on how to instruct them on how to interact with the police. Whereas, you know, with my son, that's really not a concern I have.
And frankly,
that's unfair.
That's the problem. That is the problem right there in a microcosm right there. That is the problem that exists. The question is, how do you fix it? And where is the basically the acknowledgement that it must be fixed and we must start taking the steps to fix it? And so I thought Doc Rivers was poignant and when he kind of broke down a couple nights earlier when he was, you know, he was basically saying, I love America, but it doesn't love me, you know, and it's just sad. And so that's some tough news. Let's get on to some good news here. What's going on with the unbelievable Chicago White Sox right now?
Well, they've won 10 of their last 12. You know, at one point they were 10 and 11 and now they are 20 and I think 20 and 13. And they have nearly the same record as the Chicago Cubs. They took 2 of 3 from the Cubs and they were beating the crap out of everybody. Jose Abreu was hitting home runs like you wouldn't believe. He had 6 home runs in the 3 games at Wrigley Field. There isn't a single Cubs player who's hit 6 home runs at Wrigley Field this year. And in fact, if you take Rizzo, Hayward, and I think a couple other players and combine their home run totals at Wrigley, together they haven't hit 6 home runs at Wrigley. So, you know, I mean, they're an interesting team. They have a great prospect in Luis Robert, and they have a great hitter in Jimenez, Eloy Jimenez, and sort of Jose Abreu really has found the fountain of youth. So they're an exciting team. They're certainly far more interesting than the Cubs, and quite frankly, I'll be honest, they're better than the Cubs right now.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt about it. But they're doing it in a weird way. And this is where I think they're not built to last in the playoffs because they are so strong offensively. I think they've got the best batting average in the major leagues, if I'm not mistaken, as a team. But it reminds me of the old 70s Chicago, the big lumbering Southside hitmen, because they too were an offensive juggernaut. The problem that this Sox team has is while Giolito is phenomenal and Cease has really been pitching out of his ass too, I think that they have problems with that overall pitching staff from a bullpen standpoint and depth at a starting perspective. And as we know, in a short series, you take against the Dodgers or some of the powerhouses that have a great front three, they're not going to beat those teams. I just don't think they can, not this year, but what the Sox need to do, they're missing a starter and maybe a reliever from being a world championship team. Because they're offensively so strong, they're going to win games just by the fact that they're just going to score 10 to 12 runs on you. The problem is they're going to give up 8 or 9 runs. That's the problem with the team. But I think, you know, they're absolutely on fire. And Abreu, what he did was unbelievable. AL Player of the Week, obviously. But then what happened? Lucas Giolito took the mound.
He was the first no-hitter for the White Sox since Philip Humber. And that was amazing. He was dominating.
Yeah, you know, yeah,
he was. And I think it should be mentioned that he almost gave up a hit with 2 outs in the 9th, but Adam Engel made a really nice play on a line drive to right field. He made sort of a diving catch on the ball to kind of preserve it. So that was really exciting.
Well, you know, Morrissey of the Sun-Times makes the claim that this is one of the best, from an efficiency standpoint, no hitter, perfect games of all time, for which I respond, first of all, perfect games are a go to the head of the class. So let's talk about no hitters. Maybe it's one of the best no hitters. But I watched part of that game, and he was saved by two great defensive plays. Not one, but I thought two great defense. The shortstop going over second base, you know, he was shaded towards second. Otherwise, he would not have made the play. But he made a great play two innings before, the 9th. So I'm not so sure. You know, it's funny today, whenever people say, oh, this is the greatest movie, they talk about movies that were made in the last 2 years. You know, this is the greatest play. I'm like, look, dude, go back and look at some of the black and white stuff.
I know. I mean, and you want to look at, like, Mark Burley's perfect game, that catch
Exactly. Burley's perfect game was 2 hours and 1 minute. I mean, come on.
Jerome Holtzman, or not Jerome Holtzman, but Ken Holtzman, once threw a no-hitter for the Cubs.
Two no-hitters.
I think one of them even strike out a single batter.
Jack Morris's no-hitter at Old Comiskey had like 11 walks.
Yeah.
Or something like that. A huge number.
So not all no-hitters are created equal, but he's got a no-hitter.
Right.
Good for him.
Yeah,
and
God bless him.
And good for their fans. You know, I think that they could go far this year, but I think the future is even brighter.
There's no doubt. It's been kind of arrested development because, quite honestly, we talked about in 2015 that they were going to be a world champion by now. It really hasn't happened, but it's starting to happen.
Can you imagine if they had Fernando Tatis Jr.?
Oh, yeah. Well, I know. Try not to think about that.
Not to think about that, White Sox fans.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, that'll just make you crazy because you'll never see him again unless maybe he's 38 years old and it's, you know, his rah-rah tour and the Sox took a flyer on him.
So we go from the Chicago White Sox to the New York Mets, who are the never-ending sort of clown car.
They should be called the New York Mess.
They really are. I mean, it's just the era of the Wilpons ownership is just completely crazy. And what happened recently is their general manager, Brody Van Wagenen, was caught on a hot mic criticizing the commissioner of baseball, saying that he, from a leadership point of view, he just doesn't get it, that he had spoken with the commissioner and he explained that, you know, the players weren't going to play. And the commissioner said, it's going to be a nightmare to play these games, to reschedule these games. Why don't we just have them come out at 7, walk off the field, and then come back and play the game at 8. And he was saying to some of the other Mets employees from the front office that the commissioner at a leadership level just doesn't get it. And he didn't realize that there was a hot mic. And all these reporters heard him. And he embarrassed himself. He embarrassed the Mets. And I think that he's
But it turns out that directive didn't come from Manfred. It came from Wilpon, the owner of the team. Then the owner was embarrassed. It's like, you know what? I want to say to Van Wagenen, which also, by the way, when you're gone, we won't have to worry about pronouncing your name. It sounds like a W.
You got me. I was going to say lined up.
It sounds like a WWE name, by the way. But Van Wagenen, can I get your desk clock? Because I know you're about to be fired.
Exactly. I mean, we won't have to worry about spelling his name again. You know what I mean?
He's gone.
he's gone, and probably sooner rather than later. And I really hope that Luis Rojas, the manager they hired, I hope they keep him.
Yeah.
You know, because very often when a GM goes, everybody goes.
Well, he's a great young managing talent. So if they're stupid enough to fire him, somebody else will get that. We'll pick that guy up, I think.
Yeah, that's true. So the Cleveland Indians, their rotation, as everybody knows, is just outstanding.
Yeah.
Justin Bieber, all these other young, these young pitchers, Clevinger. Yeah. And why is that?
It's Savali and Plesac and Bieber came out of the 2016 draft. That's really the thing. And that's extremely unusual that three of your four starters or five starters or whatever came from the same draft class. In fact, it's only happened a handful of times, and none of them are as good as these three, at least at this point in the season. The Indians have literally an embarrassment of riches. I don't want to get your dad overly excited, but this team could win the World Series. And it's because they have that pitching staff, and they have like two or three core players offensively that stack up as well as any teams. I just think, when you kind of delve into this story a little bit, which 538 does their typical great job on, it's showing that they're doing something a little bit different with pitchers that other teams are now starting to catch up on, like making them throw with weighted balls, using high-speed video to kind of slow down and identify certain hitches in that pitchers have with their motions. And they're doing things at a very high level, so much so that if you think about it, in the last 5 years, some of the pitchers that they've developed, certainly Kluber is the biggest one on that list, Bauer, other ones, why do they have all these pitchers? Well, it could be how they're bringing these pitchers up have something to do with it. Now, not taking anything away from, Plesac, Savali, or Bieber, because they, Bieber particularly, I think he could win the Cy Young in the American League. He's pitching so well. But is it the coaches? Is it the shoes? Why are you guys so good?
Well, let's go back to a book I read earlier or last year, The MVP Machine. And, the Indians acquired Trevor Bauer from the Arizona Diamondbacks. And when they acquired him, they didn't just acquire him because they thought he was a good pitcher, because Bauer was having all sorts of problems in Arizona with his crazy training regimens and things like that.
Yeah.
He just wasn't fitting in. He wasn't getting along with teammates. So they had a sit down with him, and they said that they wanted to let him, Bauer, be sort of who he is, do what he wants to do, train the way he wants to train. But really, they weren't acquiring him just to have Bauer as a pitcher, but they wanted him to teach them how to develop pitchers, to kind of change the way that they sort of look at pitchers, acquire pitchers, and develop pitchers. And I think that it was Bauer's presence within their organization that kind of was a blueprint for the way that they do this.
Well, it's interesting because just like every other successful organization, now other teams are starting to cherry pick those coaches away from the Indians because they know how successful, and they were integral parts in baseball, and basically this pitching machine that they've created in Cleveland. It's just, it's pretty impressive.
It really is.
Before we move on to talking about the Cubs, I wanted to mention that it was reported late yesterday that the Anaheim Angels have traded Tommy LaStella over to the Athletics for, I don't know what basically the player to be named later scenario, yeah. Bag of balls and some score sheets. But I guess the question I'm kind of asking is, and I think you have a different set of news to report on this, is it possible that Madden doesn't like LaStella? Because it seems like wherever Madden is, LaStella has to go. I'm just going to throw that out there.
I don't think that Madden had anything to do with that trade. And I heard reports, you know, just on talk radio, that Madden was really upset that they had traded LaStella.
Of course he is. Yeah. Just like he was upset when he got traded out of the Cubs organization.
Well, I mean, when he was traded from the Cubs, or whether he left as a free agent, I mean, when he went to Anaheim, he was going to get a chance to play every day. And once he got that chance, he really made the most of it. You know, and I don't know. I mean, it's good for Tommy LaStella in that he goes from a team that at the time of the trade was 11-22 to a team 22-11. So he went from worst to first in one day, you know, and so, you know, good for him in that regard. I hope that he helps the A's. You know, they need a middle infielder, and he's a strong left-handed bat. I think that it's crazy that the Angels let him go.
Well, I think the Angels have to be in the mode of, like, can we get future talent, because we're a very bad team and we have to kind of fortify, you know, what we're doing here for the future.
Well, they traded him for an infielder named Franklin Barreto. And what the Angels need more than anything is pitching.
Correct. Correct.
Bad. I don't understand what they're doing. So, I mean, that's not a team I really follow so closely, but I can't imagine that that's being received as a good move.
I'll be honest with you. I never was, you know, I never thought LaStella was all that in a bag of chips. I just, you know, I liked saying his name from a Marlon Brando standpoint, but as a player, I thought the fact that he was an all-star last year was kind of a flukish. Tommy LaStella was an all-star. I mean, I don't mean to start laughing on you, but it's kind of humorous to me.
Well, when he's your second best player, you know,
exactly.
Then maybe you have some issues, but they're paying so much money to Justin Upton and Mike Trout. I mean, and Albert Pujols. I mean, it's difficult for them to acquire pitchers and keep a payroll that's reasonable.
Yeah. So, but I think that there was just something else at play here from a personality standpoint, that basically it was a light hitting middle infielder for a light hitting middle infielder. Why did you make the trade?
Well, LaStella, he's got that surprising power, man.
Yeah, he does.
But he does. So I want to move on to the Chicago Cubs, and I want to begin with Yu Darvish's gem yesterday in Cincinnati. He pitched the opening game of a seven inning of a doubleheader.
Right.
And he pitched six innings of shutout ball in a seven inning game. I wanted to ask you, can this guy win the Cy Young?
Oh, there's no question that he can. He's full on back from that surgery, which is great. And it's basically in the timeline. It's about 18 months, right? Some people are like, oh, you can do it in a year. No, you really can't. It takes a long time to come back from it. But it appears as though he's better than ever, because his stuff is just dominating right now. And I will say, he benefits from the seven-inning game, a part of a doubleheader. It's like, can you pitch you in every doubleheader? Because that's like the perfect amount of innings for him, because he starts to weather a little bit in the sixth inning. The other guy that comes to mind is Scherzer. Scherzer was like that too. He'd be dominating for seven innings, and then the eighth inning, the wheels would fall off. So it's interesting, but he's just – if you watch him pitch, first of all, he has like 11 or 12 pitches. He has pitches that you never heard of before. But when you look at the strike zone, he can literally paint all four corners of the strike zone with command. And so whenever you have that kind of, you know, it reminds you a little bit of Maddox, but in a different way, because Darvish throws harder than Maddox ever did. But he has that kind of control and different pitch styles. Like, he throws just – three or four different types of, you know, sliders so he's difficult to hit. He commands his pitching, and he's a power pitcher. Those are all dominating things that is enough to scare a lot of hitters, I would think. And yes, he has a legitimate chance at winning the Cy Young. Yes.
I hope he does. That would be very nice for the Cubs, who look like they're going to be in the playoffs. I don't think, I mean, when you look at the National League Central, you know, they have a 4.5 game lead. They're not exactly blowing the doors off anybody, but it's not like the rest of the division seems very interested in winning either. So, you know,
they're paper tigers. If you're familiar with that expression, it just, they look ferocious, but they're not. And I think when it gets to the playoffs, they're going to get knocked right out. That's what I think is going to happen. I hope it doesn't happen. And as you know, there's a certain element of luck involved where anybody could get hot at a certain time. I'm just fearful because, again, I watched you yesterday, and then I watched basically the last three innings of the second game. Oh. And when Kimbrel came in to pitch, I thought, well, you know, Kimbrel's pitched well the three of his last four outings. This could be a quick sweep of a doubleheader, as it should have been. Kimbrel looked like shit. And mostly because he was wild. He could not find the strike zone.
I mean, he walked hitters. He had three wild pitches.
Yeah, and one was a really bad one. It wasn't even close. It looked like Kevin Soche.
I mean, he didn't give Contreras a chance to catch those balls.
Correct.
And it was terrible.
Yep.
That was a crushing loss. You know, once he allowed the Reds to tie the game, you know, it just was a matter of time. And, you know, he's got some issues. And I don't know if he's going to be great one day and terrible the next. But, you know, it's just been really hard to watch him struggle. Because, this team could really be good.
Over the last few years, the Cubs have had four or five games in the season that are just heartbreaking losses. And there's only 60 games in this season. This is one of those heartbreaking losses. We just didn't need to lose this game. Had nothing to do with Ross. Ross managed that game perfectly. Kimbrel just didn't do his job.
They've won two of the first three of a four-game series and have a chance to take three or four. Now they have to win today to just earn the split. I mean, it's just
I have a developing theory. And that is that when a player has passed his born on dating greatness, and then you pay him money that commiserated with his talent at his greatness level, that it almost always ends in failure. If you have 10 cases, maybe one where the player actually gets better over the next few years, but usually they don't. And when you're committing $12 to $14 million in today's money on a has been reliever, I don't want to say it out loud. I'll whisper it. He's a has been. You get what you pay for, and we got shit. And this is one of those ones where it's like, Theo, since 2015, you won us a title. You'll never pay for a drink in this town again. But you've made a lot of bonehead decisions. I'm sorry.
And I've always said that in 2016, every decision he made was worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, the law of averages has really caught up with him.
Theo will always have 2016.
And then, you know, this series with the Reds comes on the heels of dropping 2 of 3 to the Tigers.
Oh, my God.
Watch that.
You cannot lose 2 to 3 to the Tigers. You can't.
Well, it just looked like their heart wasn't in it at all. You know, it just – I don't know.
I'm telling you that there's still a couple other teams within the Central. I'm kind of combining the AL and the NL at this point. Like, what's going to happen when the Cubs have to play the Indians again? Don't they have to play them a fair amount of games? Because I'm telling you right now, the Indians will crush the Cubs.
They played the Indians twice, and they missed all their big stars because Zach Plesac.
Oh, yeah, okay, right.
Clevenger, they'd gone out in Chicago and violated the COVID protocols.
Yeah.
So I think they play them again, two more games, maybe. I'm not sure.
Well, that's fortuitous for the Cubs because I'm telling you right now, they're not as good as them. I don't think they're as good as Minnesota. They're definitely not as good as the White Sox.
Yeah.
But you look at the rest of the teams in the NL Central, and the Cardinals included, they're all in the minus as far as their run differential. They're just not very good teams. And neither are the Cubs. I mean, that's just.
I mean, they're the best of kind of an ordinary bunch of teams. I mean, they have a couple of things that are good. You know, they have Darvish, who's really good, and you know, Hendricks is okay, I guess, and you know, they have some good players on offense, but they're just it's just not.
You know, and Lester has truly become that wins one, lose one pitcher. He'll throw a gem and then he gets rocked. And there's going to be more of that with him because of the age of that arm. So you cannot lose two games to the Tigers. I'm sorry, in a three game series, it's just you're not going to advance in the playoffs with that kind of.
And I mentioned that their heart wasn't in it in their series against Detroit, and this was when you know. Jason Hayward sat out a game because of the Jacob Blake thing.
Oh, I'm glad you brought this up because this kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. Why didn't the Cubs just sit out the game? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think it's easy to kind of say that, you know, and they were kind of scrambling. Both players and front office personnel were scrambling to try to figure out what's the right thing to do. And, you know, they asked Hayward, they're like, what do you want us to do? And Hayward's like, look, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I can't tell you what's the right thing.
Right.
I can't play. If you guys want to play, I don't have a problem with it, you know, but the Cubs players themselves were kind of upset that they felt like they didn't back their teammate up. And I kind of get it, but then there's all sorts of other things to worry about. I mean, you know, you got to get these games in. It's a nightmare to reschedule. So they went ahead and played them. I don't begrudge the Cubs necessarily for deciding to play that game. I mean, it's a difficult situation for everybody, but
I got to tell you, I understand what you're saying. It just kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. All these other teams were in, you know, solidarity. What happened in Miami was phenomenal, I thought, which is basically they all came out and then they left the Black Lives Matter at home plate and walked off the field collectively. That was impressive. So it's a complicated situation, but I just thought the Hayward's the only one that didn't play kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. You've read any good books lately?
Yeah, I got my summer reading in, and this is 10 Innings. Okay, this is a book by Kevin Cook. Basically, it's about a game that took place on May 17th, 1979 at Wrigley Field between the Phillies and the Cubs. And
it was the wind blowing out that day, Leo?
The wind was blowing out that day. The final score was 23-22 in 10 innings. The Phillies A pitcher's duel, exactly. And, you know, it's a really good book because it's told really in three parts. It gives you a history of both the Phillies and the Cubs. And then he documents the 10-inning slugfest, and he gives it to you half inning by half inning, you know, talking about what announcers were saying, what certain fans who were present at the ballpark were saying. And then he gives you the legacies of some of the players who stood out that day, Tug McGraw, Bob Boone, Dave Kingman, Bill Buckner, and Donnie Moore, you know. And Kingman that day, he had three home runs.
Right.
Including what may have been the longest home run ever hit at Wrigley. It went three houses up Kenmore Avenue, that comes in perpendicular to Waveland over there in left field, which was a shot, you know. Yep. Bob Boone had his best offensive day of his career. He was 3-for-5 with 5 RBIs and a double and a home run. Larry Boa was 5-for-8. Gary Maddux was 4-for-4. Listen to this one. This is hilarious. In the first inning, on the top of the first inning, the Phillies scored 7 runs, okay? Yeah, Philly starting pitcher Randy Lurch hit a home run in the top of the first. Now, he didn't last beyond one-third of an inning in the bottom of the first, but both he and Bob Boone, homered in that game. That's the last time both ends of a battery have homered in the same game in the major leagues.
Wow. It's not likely to happen again with the way that they're throwing this DH thing around. Yeah. You know, this was before ESPN, and I kind of remember this even living in Detroit because this made the national news, this game. And that was a very unusual thing to hear, you know, John Chancellor talking about a baseball game at Wrigley. So it just was an offense. It was just one of those weird – has there ever been a game like that before or since from a total run standpoint?
I think there was a game similar to that against the Reds. I don't think it went as far or as many runs were scored. But Certainly when the wind is blowing out, that is a tough time for pitchers. And Buckner had a comment that he really hated playing there because, you know, when the wind's blowing in and you crush a ball and it's just a pop out to an outfielder, all the hitters scream. But then when the wind changes and it's blowing out and a pop fly becomes a three-run home run, all the pitchers scream.
Right.
So, you know.
What a game.
In some of the legacy stuff, I just want to mention that how awful Dave Kingman was to report.
I know.
He hated women reporters. He sent a rat, a live rat in a box to a female reporter from the Sacramento Bee when he was playing with the Oakland A's.
Yeah.
I mean, but then there was also a story about his prodigious strength that he had a yacht in San Diego. When the Cubs came to San Diego, he invited them all out to the yacht for a party. He had a keg in a 30-gallon trash can full of ice, and he had to move it to make room for some of his friends, and he picked it up with his bare hands and moved it. All the other players tried to move it, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't budge it, you know.
Yeah, Kingman was a lot of things, but he was a world-class asshole. I mean, there's no question about it. And he may, when it's all said and done, who knows, thousands of years from now, have the distinction as having the most amount of home runs and not being in the Hall of Fame. Because he hit a shitload of home runs. I mean,
447.
Yeah. I mean, but he doesn't go into the Hall for many reasons.
And one other thing I want to mention is Donnie Moore, who gave up the home run in the 1986 ALCS.
Which led to his suicide.
Dave Henderson, which led to his suicide. A lot of people forget that he did an attempted murder suicide. He tried to kill his wife that day. He shot her in the chest. And her daughter, their daughter, Demetria, drove his wife to the hospital where Tanya, the wife, got out of the car under her own power and walked into the ER with having shot in the chest.
I know that Donnie Moore was a tormented soul, and it's a total tragedy. But it's my understanding that that run that he gave up led to his downfall. Like, he couldn't recover from it. So
no, he really he never did. And no one knew what he was struggling with. But
so there's a really – this COVID business, as we know, is just a human tragedy on many different levels. But you're starting to see teams now reduce their staff. And so we talked about this a little while ago about the White Sox, who basically cut a bunch of player development and scouting staff. And that, you know, we both remarked that, you know, Reinsdorf is somebody that takes care of his people. So for that to start to happen, it's scary. And now the Cubs are doing it. The Cubs are basically cutting out layers, just like the White Sox did, of player development and scouting folks. And the sad and scary part of it is there's a percentage of these that will not be rehired.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. A lot of these guys, I mean, you like to think that, you know, this is just temporary and that baseball, if it comes back like it was before, that these guys would all get their jobs back, but not all of them are going to get their jobs back. Not all of them. Move on to other teams. Some will retire outright. Some just won't be hired back anywhere. And it's sad.
One of the things that we talked about was, you know, the fact that there's really no minor league games. You know, I'm up at Michigan this weekend, and I was able to drive by the minor league park in Grand Rapids. And you think about how much this impacts these small town economies. It's not just the fact that there's not the games being played, but what the financial impact is, and also the stunted growth of the players. I mean, no one's talking about these players not playing and what that means a year or two from now. You know, how does that impact the game?
The guys will be coming up. They won't be ready to play. I mean, it's going to stunt their own personal development as players. And you really, you know, there's no minor league games to see. So how do you justify keeping these scouts on the payroll when there's really nothing for them to do?
Right.
You know, but it also makes it incredibly difficult to make trades to improve your club because you can't see any players. You can't get reports to see how they're doing. So this is a dark time, man, and we'll be lucky if we live through it all.
Well, give us some good popcorn today.
Absolutely. Well, I got to choose the movie this week, and I chose one of my all-time favorites, a movie from 1994 called Belle Époque, a Spanish language film directed by Fernando Trueba. And basically it begins with, there's a civil war kind of going on within Spain, and the Republic is trying to assert itself. And a young soldier, a bugle player from a regiment, just a young kid, deserts. Yeah. And he's being taken away. He's being taken to justice by these two guardias, these guards, who end up killing each other.
I know.
So now the soldier, this young boy, finds himself alone in the middle of nowhere.
Orphaned.
He hooks up with this old man, Don Manolo, who's an artist. And he ends up cooking for him, and they have these conversations with the priest, and it's all very nice. But then he thinks that he has to go back to Madrid, so he goes to the train station, and Don Manolo happens to be there. And as the train arrives, Don Manolo's four daughters get off the train, and they're all beautiful. Yeah. They're all incredible. You know, one after the other gets off the train. And one of them is played by Penelope Cruz. And by the way, this is her first movie.
Right.
And, you know, they're all just beautiful women. So the boy decides that he's going to stay.
The bugler.
He understands. He's like, you decided to stay. I wonder why.
Right.
But then he ends up sleeping with all four daughters. And it's just, each situation is so absurd, but it's great, you know.
Well, the funniest part was when one of the daughters is a lesbian, and she was dressed as a man for this festival, and Manola, played by Fernando Fernan Gomez, who did a great job, by the way. This movie, as Ebert talked about, is intertwined with the American film Some Like It Hot, directed by Billy Wilder. And this is a very much a Some Like It Hot kind of a sex comedy farce, as they used to call these films. You don't really see them that much anymore. They were really big in the 70s in Italy with Laura Antonelli, who was just one of the most beautiful women that had zero acting talent, but she was really unbelievable to look at on the screen. This is just a charming, charming movie. I'm so glad you picked it. I hadn't seen it. And unfortunately, you can't watch it on any of the normal ways. I had to watch it a copy online in Spanish. And so, as you know, I've been studying Spanish, so I know a lot of stuff. I was able to kind of figure out. It just is a charming, charming film, and I'm so glad you picked it, because it just Penelope Cruz is like, she's very young. I think she's like 17 or 18 when this film was made. She's just beguiling. I mean, there's no other way of. And when she's on the screen, no one else is on the screen.
Well, but there are two scenes in particular that I love. And the first one is when Violetta, the lesbian, you know what I mean?
Right.
Dressed as a man while the boy is dressed as a woman for this festival, and the girls get together and they basically tackle him.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they force him to put on a dress and go to the festival. Right. And all these old men who are drunk start hitting on him because they think he's a woman. And then Violetta, who's dressed as a soldier and she has a mustache on, she defends his honor.
Right, exactly.
She basically just takes him, you know, and it's hysterical.
This is all, by the way, on both male and female's perspective, before the Me Too movement and you know, the woke time, because a lot of parts of sex farces historically are wildly inappropriate. You cannot do the things that they do. And certainly it could only happen because of the four daughters, the beautiful daughters, wanted it to happen. If it was four boys and one girl, this would be like a Jodie Foster film. Not a good thing, right? So
right, because the women, you're right, the women are in control. You know what I mean?
Completely.
And that's what was really cool about it. And then it's really funny how Don Manolo is married and his wife is an opera singer on tour. And he says that he can't have an erection for any woman except for his wife.
Yeah, you know what I mean? that's a very Mike Pence thing for him to say. But you know, I got to say, Ebert gave it 3.5 stars. I give it 4 stars.
Wow.
I think it was a It was a great film. It was not, you know, 3.5 stars. It's almost a great film. This was a great film. And you'll never forget it. It was the first time I saw it. I'll never forget it.
And how about Rocio, played by Maribel Verdú? She played in the movie Y Tu Mamá También. She
was Yeah.
She's the hottest of the four, I thought.
I thought so too. From the very first scene when you see her, even though Penelope Cruz, you can't take your eyes off her. You're like, that other one, she's actually more attractive. She's more beautiful than Penelope
Cruz. Rocio is just unbelievable. Yeah.
But Cruz's personality just kind of lights up the screen.
No, it's a great movie. It really is. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm sorry you didn't get to see it with subtitles, but I'm glad that you were able to understand a lot.
Oh, yeah. Let's put it this way. I will definitely watch that film again. It really was good.
Well, that's good to hear. All right. So now, do you have a movie for our popcorn segment for next week?
I do. And so it's kind of in a related realm in the sense that it's a Spanish film as well. We're going to go with number 41 on my all-time list. It's the 2006 Guillermo del Toro's El Laberinto del Fauno, Pan's Labyrinth.
Pan's Labyrinth. Okay. All right. Good. Another Spanish film.
Yes.
I think some of the actresses in this movie, in Bella Puck, are in Pan's Labyrinth, too.
Correctamundo.
Correctamundo. All right. Well, I'm fired up because I haven't seen Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, that man. Oh, man. Yeah. It's an all-time classic.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I mean, I just never got around to seeing it. I mean, Julie hates to see movies with subtitles, so I just never, you know, so this will be good. I'm looking forward to seeing this. All right. So until next week, we are the Two Peas in the Podcast.
I'll bang the drum slowly and play the fife lowly. Play the dead march as they carry me along. Put bunches of roses all over my coffin. Roses to deaden the clods as they fall.